Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks in the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to resume with the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, which is part of the Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews series, volume number 3, put out by the researchers of Louis Farrakhan's The Nation of Islam. And I encourage you to buy the book, read the details and the footnotes, buy it from Nation of Islam, not from the Jewish Amazon. Today we're going to do a little shorter bit as we near the end from 4:15 up to 4:34, so it will take less than an hour. And then we'll have another, I believe, about two more sessions and we'll conclude the book. So, picking up on 4:14, we're in the greater section that we've been in the last two times, the cross-examination of Leo Frank. This subsection begins, The Concocted Conley Confessions, page 4:15. Frank's team understood that between the physical evidence and Conley's own meticulous narrative, the odds of success were not in their favor. So through his friends and hired operatives, Frank, quote, made it known inside the jail where Conley was being held that he and his legal team were actually, quote, in the market for a confession from Conley. The extent, and that's a direct quote, in the market for a confession from Conley, like pay a guard to beat him up or pay another prisoner to induce it somehow. The extent that the Frank team was willing to go to obtain this quote-unquote evidence is demonstrated in a handwritten letter sent to Frank from a colored man dated April 20th, 1915, and here transcribed exactly as written, with spelling, grammar, and punctuation intact. Quote, Mr. Leo M. Franks, sir, I know in my nervy heart and soul that it was Canley that killed the Fagan girl. I'm just going to read it phonically. That is, as it sounds, as it's spelled. There's lots of errors in it. He told me the day before that he had no meanie and that he had a good mind to kill the first one he met that had any meanie, money spelled M-A-N-E-Y, no matter how small it was. I feel like a bull, he said to me as a little girl passed by as we were talking, capitalizing random words, as we were talking just outside of Frank's place. He said to me, oh my, if I only had her for 1/2 hour, I would have, unknown. From the night after Mary was murdered, I took several drunks with him. He had $1 bill and 50 cents, and I asked him where he got the money, but he told me to shut up. I told him that I was going to Philadelphia, and he said, wait for me, I will be brought up for this crime and lynched. And despite the tortured syntax of this twisted testimonial, the envelope in which the letter arrived carried the perfectly spelled inscription, please give this letter to Mr. Frank. No one accepts this letter as authentic, coming as it did a full 2 years after the murder. The telltale mix of stylistic anomalies is very close in form to the two murder notes, such that the envelope might have more accurately said, please give this letter back to Mr. Frank. But there are several examples of alleged confessions falsely attributed to James Conley. There are several examples of them. Shortly after Conley's revelations about the murder became public, an insurance salesman named William Mincy, M-I-N-C-E-Y, emerged claiming Conley had confessed to him. He was deemed a marquee witness that would clear Leo Frank, but he never showed up at the trial, and, according to Harry Golden, one of the Jews who wrote about it decades later, he was, quote, an obvious fraud and publicity seeker who dealt the defense a staggering blow, unquote. The New York Times, proving itself willing to accept, quote, unsupported Negro testimony, unquote, in this instance, italics, reported that a Negro, believing himself at the point of death, swore that Frank was innocent and that a certain Negro had killed the Fagan girl. The report was false, but when it was cruelly relayed to Frank's elderly mother, she, quote, expressed thanks that at the last his name had been cleared. And then all caps, Frank's friends will try to get Conley to confess. That is the actual first page headline of the Atlanta Journal of November 10, 1913, more than 2 months after the conviction of Leo Frank in an Atlanta court of law. The article elaborated, quote, "Friends of Leo M. Frank asserted they will endeavor to induce the police to make an effort to secure a confession from the Negro. Who the friends are and how this inducing would occur are not disclosed, but the brazen audacity of the act on Frank's behalf is revealing." Another even more telling headline in the Atlanta Journal of March 12, 1914 reads, "Sleuth will try to force confession from Negro that he, and not Frank, slew Mary Fagan, it is said." And that's a headline from the Atlanta Journal, one of the three dailies there in Atlanta. The second paragraph in it states that, quote, "Frank's hired detective, William J. Burns, has forced confessions from criminals where many others had failed. And it is believed he will use his powers to get the Negro to admit that he knows more about the murder than he told on the witness stand." Despite this threat of enhanced interrogation, Conley was yet willing to meet with Burns, his only condition being that some disinterested white man be present to see that he is given fair treatment. Many overeager writers have alleged that at various times Conley confessed to the murder of Mary Fagan, but this is, as Oney writes, only wishful thinking. Here are a few traceable instances of made-up tales of Conley confessions. Five bullet points. First, Leo Frank's main appeals attorney, Lewis Marshall, the number one Jew in America, spread the idea that while in prison, Conley, quote, confessed that Frank had nothing to do with the murder, unquote. Number one Jew in America willing to lie. Significant. Second bullet. Harry Golden flat out fabricated the claim that Conley told at least three people he killed Mary Fagan, so a book writer decades later willing to lie. A Jew. Harry Golden willing to lie. Flat out fabricated the claim that Conley told at least three people he killed Mary Fagan. Think about how remarkable. This is not something just to blip over. You know, we go through this stuff, and quick or slow, there's so much of it. It's so impacted. It's so protracted. It's so repetitive. But one little thing in itself, I mean, tells you the nature of this race. I mean, he's willing to make up that Conley, direct quote, told at least three people he killed Mary Fagan. So the Jews don't have the same view of lying that whites do. Since they all do. We're only two of the five bullet points in. We've already got the number one Jew in America, and we've got a book writer, a serious writer who's published, concocting a flat-out fabricated claim. They're a race of liars. The lowest Jew, Leo Frank, pedophile, rapist, and murderer, is worth, in their eyes, and by their values, and by their religious code, infinitely more than any other hominid creature. They don't see other humans as fellow men. They see them as the equivalent of a less than an insect. And their destruction of any other non-Jew creature as less significant than swatting a mosquito on your arm or something. Third bullet point. Harry Simon and Hoff, wishfully claimed that 10 years after Frank's lynching, a convict, quote, confessed to the crime and implicated Jim Conley. Another lie. I don't know who Simon Hoff was. Four, an Anti-Defamation League operative in Atlanta named Dale Schwartz made the preposterous claim that Conley confessed, quote, thousands of times. Unquote. Fifth bullet point. Robert Frey, F-R-E-Y, retreads Burns's phony Annie Maud Carter letters in claiming that Conley, quote, confessed the murder to her several times. Lie, 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 and it should be lies, 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 lies in most of those. Next section, Mr. Smith goes to confession. The, quote, confession, given the most weight, is the one Conley supposedly made to his, quote, volunteer attorney William M. Smith. Noted Harvard lawyer Alan Dershowitz blustered with certainty in 2004 that Connally admitted to Smith that he had killed Mary Fagan. He wrote, quote, "It seems certain that the actual killer was James Connally and that his own lawyer knew that to be the case." Unquote. Alan Dershowitz a liar. All the top Jews are liars. What do you think, the middle and the lesser Jews are lesser liars? They're all liars. They're a race of liars. Lying is their culture. Lying is their seed. Lying is their essence. Lying defines them, from the Aryan point of view at least. A year after Frank's 1913 trial and Connally's decisive role in convincing Atlanta of Frank's guilt, Smith publicly expressed his belief that his client was in fact the guilty man. He felt it unnecessary to explain how he came to that conclusion, but many Frank partisans have on their own turned Smith's opinion into a full-fledged Connally confession. Smith's oddly worded statement was more ambiguous than its overambitious interpreters suggest. He said, "I am sure that investigation by the proper authorities will prove conclusively that the black man is the man who is the slayer." Smith's statement came in October of 1914, a full year and 2 months after Frank's conviction. The, quote, "proper authorities" had long ago concluded that Frank was the murderer, and their opinion was buttressed, rather embarrassingly, by Frank's own privately hired investigative authorities, that is Burns and Ferguson, or Pinkerton and Burns, private investigators, hired by Frank, who both independently concluded he was the murderer, and by a series of appeals judges. So basically everyone seriously involved in the case found him guilty. This alleged about-face by Smith has been presented as a righteous fit of conscience, strong enough to invalidate Connally's attorney-client privilege. But Smith had his own shady motives and suspicious connections. In the very same milquetoast public statement declaring his defection to the Frank camp, Smith explains that, quote, "There were several reasons for my undertaking this work, and one of them was my promise to William J. Burns and Burns Detective Dan S. Lehan that if the Burns Agency would help Mrs. Nelms to locate the girls, Eloise and Beatrice Nelms, or punish their murderer, that I would give more time than I had to work on the Frank case, and whatever results I was able to get, I would contribute to the case." The Nelms sisters were friends of Smith's, and they had been abducted, leaving no trace. He appears to have bargained away the legal rights of Connally to gain the assistance of Burns in solving the Nelms' disappearance. There is no clearer avenue to disbarment than Smith's own admitted motives. Burns, we are reminded, just a few months before, had said that he would prove that Smith's client, James Connally, quote, "is the Jack the Ripper who murdered about 20 Negro girls in the last 3 years," close quote. And he went to extraordinary and illegal lengths to fabricate evidence of Connally's guilt. It was also through Burns that much of Albert Lasker's dirty money flowed into Atlanta to bribe, threaten, and blackmail many witnesses, both harmful and helpful, to Leo Frank. Smith's client was the main target of Burns' high-octane chicanery, and Smith retaliated with some of the most condemnatory words about Burns' methods in the March 21, 1914 Atlanta Constitution. Quote, "If the papers are correctly quoting William J. Burns, this movie picture, stage lecturing, tangoing sleuth, following his usual methods of playing to the galleries, he must prove not only a disappointment to his employers, but a downright injury to the cause in which he was hired, and for which, I presume, he is being paid. It ought to be to the everlasting shame and disgrace of William J. Burns, should he come here to perform a high service for truth's sake and sacrifice it upon the altar of his desire for publicity. This is no time for bombast and braggartry. For once give us the facts, give us light, give us truth, and eliminate the advertising program, lest you crucify where you seek to save." William M. Smith. Burns yet got the better of Smith. For several months, Smith had employed the services of Detective Carlton Tedder, T-E-D-D-E-R, with whom Smith no doubt had shared many intimate and confidential details of the case. Tedder was later revealed to have been a planted mole of the William J. Burns Agency. Though Tedder was later indicted for a host of unethical operations on Frank's behalf, it might easily be surmised that the data gathered in Burns' slimy operation were a factor in Smith's incredible pivot against his own client. Smith's turnabout is all the more shocking when one examines his strident and anti-Frank position earlier in the case. He blasted the defendant in a very public way. Comparing his own client's behavior with that of Leo Frank, Smith said, quote, "He is not skulking coward-like behind the protection of iron bars, nor have his lips been sealed with tomb-like silence until he can spring suddenly in a court, a well-prepared statement which the state has no opportunity to investigate and disprove. Conley allows himself to be grilled, cross-examined, and unceasingly questioned by the representatives of the state. He is talking and talking now. Conley says to the state of Georgia, 'Here is my story. Investigate it. Sift it. And prove it a lie if you can.'" And Smith, here in the very midst of Frank's trial in July 1913, refers unflatteringly to the very cabal that he joined a year later. "Prosecutor Dorsey," this is a direct quote, "is fighting brains, money, and influence. I know that he is standing by what he thinks right, and with constant threats thrown at him that they will defeat him at the next election, and with every handicap thrown in his way and the discharge of his duty in prosecuting a white man who has wealth and influence. It is the supreme test of a man's good character, and I glory in the fact that Hugh Dorsey has those high and honorable traits of his good father and mother that enables him to know the right, and knowing the right to dare to do it." And indeed, that is an accurate assessment of Hugh Dorsey's character, and that's why the Jews defame him as the very opposite of the good, honorable man that he was in their Alfred Uhry written musical Parade that's circulating around the country. It is hard to imagine a white man confronting another on behalf of a Negro in a more brutally direct way. Smith came to this firm belief in Frank's guilt only after thoroughly vetting Conley's story. It must be remembered that Smith was sent to Conley not as a sympathetic defender of the black man's civil rights, but as a hired mercenary of Atlanta's corporate elite. The Atlanta Georgian, the pro-Frank Hearst newspaper, had paid Smith's meager fee to represent the destitute black man, the paper being motivated by no other reason than to secure inside exclusives. In that duplicitous role, Smith attempted to get the steadfast Conley to change details of his account, and even undertook a number of underhanded efforts to trick his own client. He arranged for a police officer to sneak into a crawl space over Conley's cell to eavesdrop on him while he was speaking with his visiting wife. But Conley spotted the clumsy intruder, foiling that plot. Smith tried then to deceive Conley into giving him a sample of his fingerprints, presumably so that he could try to match them with other murder scene evidence. In each of these incidents, Conley became suspicious and overcame the scheming of his very own lawyer. For Christ's sake, this is how bad the deck was stacked against this guy, and he still sailed through with flying colors. Can you imagine it? Ultimately, Smith became a true and very public believer in the state's case against Leo Frank. Little is known about the actual arrangement Smith had with the Georgian, but after Frank's disastrous trial, William Randolph Hearst, one of the world's richest men, remember, out of San Simeon out in California on the coast there, Rosebud and that whole film, became personally involved in Frank's crusade for redemption, and between all those incredibly powerful forces, Smith succumbed to the reality that he might never work as an attorney again, ever. The ultimate judgment of his character occurred 3 years after Frank's lynching, when in 1918, Smith went to New York and, quote, "accepted a job with the William Burns Detective Agency." The dead-end graveyard gig for the quintessential shyster. William Smith said and wrote no more in the Leo Frank case until his very last day on Earth in 1949. On his deathbed, he was claimed to have scrawled this statement. Direct quote, "In articles of death, I believe in the innocence and good character of Leo M. Frank. In sort of block letters and weak handwriting or weak printing. The script shows that the writer is in deep distress, yet someone of Frank's agents seemed to have prevailed upon a dying Smith to address the Leo Frank case. Smith was alive and well in the 35 years between his abandonment of his black client in 1914 and his death in 1949, but he refused to offer any details about the case in all that time. That fact alone raises real concerns about not only the circumstances surrounding his purported last words, but exactly who compelled him to make such a statement at that critical moment. The Jews are squeezing these bogus statements out of dying men on their deathbed. Unbelievable. That really, again, every last little, everywhere you move the microscope on this trial and on these Jews, you see them up to something dirty. And they keep at it. They're very, very, the most remarkable thing about the race is the pertinacity, the pertinaciousness. They keep on and on and on, going after stuff. And the fact they're on the side of lies and death and murder and bad things, they don't care. So evidently that's what they are. And that ends that subsection. Now on to 423, Manola McKnight in the Leo Frank confession. Manola McKnight, now Leo Frank, now she's like his cook. You know, he's living with his Jewish wife. They're married at her in-laws, the Seligs' house, and they have a black couple serving them. It's like, I don't know, a butler or whatever, and his wife, his black wife, who is Manola McKnight, who is their cook. I suppose she did other maid things as well, but epigraph. Her first name is Manola. She is a colored woman, Leo Frank. James Connolly never confessed to killing Mary Fagan. But there is a confession on record that contains far more substance than any of those attributed to Connolly. It was a confession that Leo Frank made himself in the privacy of his own home to his own wife. It came to public notice by way of the black cook employed in Frank's home. At 20 years old, Manola McKnight might today be in a college or have her own business, but in 1913, she had already been working for 2 years as a servant in the Jewish household of Leo Frank, who lived with his wife and her parents at their home. As she put it at the trial, quote, "I work for Mrs. Selig. I cook for her." Direct quote. The young woman swore in an affidavit that on Sunday, April 27th, the morning after the murder, she had overheard Lucille Frank, his wife, tell her mother that Leo had admitted to murdering Mary Fagan. So Leo Frank's wife tells her mother that her husband, Leo Max Frank, admitted to murdering Mary Fagan, and it's overheard by her cook, Manola McKnight. Boom goes the dynamite. Lucille revealed that her distraught husband, Leo Max Frank, had been drinking heavily and threatening to commit suicide. In the shocking affidavit, McKnight also confirmed that Lucille had refused to visit her husband in jail for at least 2 weeks, adding to the public speculation that the suspect's own wife believed him to be guilty. Moreover, Manola McKnight strongly suggested that she had been bribed with extra pay to keep those facts from investigators. Here is the original affidavit McKnight swore out on June 3, 1913, about 5 weeks after the murder, in the presence of her attorney. The detail of her recollection is significant. A good long block quote here. Sunday, Miss Lucille, Frank's wife, said to Mrs. Selig, Lucille Frank's mother, that Mr. Frank didn't rest so good Saturday night. She said he was drunk and wouldn't let her sleep with him, and she said she slept on the floor on the rug by the bed because Mr. Frank was drinking. Miss Lucille said Sunday that Mr. Frank told her Saturday night that he was in trouble and that he didn't know the reason why he would murder, and he told his wife to get his pistol and let him kill himself. I heard Miss Lucille say that to Mrs. Selig, and it got away with Mrs. Selig. That means affected her. It got away with his, she meant it affected her mighty bad. She didn't know what to think. I haven't heard Miss Lucille say whether she believed it or not. Yeah, like, why in the world would he make something like that up? There's absolutely no reason. I don't know why Mrs. Frank didn't come to see her husband in jail, but it was a pretty good while before she would come to see him, maybe 2 weeks. She would tell me, quote, "Wasn't it mighty bad that he was locked up?" she would say. "Manola, I don't know what I'm going to do." When I left home to go to the Solicitor General's office, they told me to mind how I talked. They pay me $3.50 a week, $3.50 a week, but last week they paid me $4, and 1 week she paid me up $6.50. Up to the time of the murder, I was getting $3.50 a week, and the week right after the murder, I don't remember how much she paid me, and the next week they paid me $3.50, and the next week they pay me $6.50, and the next week they pay me $4, and the next week they paid me $4. 1 week, I don't remember which one, Mrs. Sella gave me $5, but it wasn't for my work, and they didn't tell me what it was for. She just said, "Here's $5, Manola." I understood that it was a tip for me to keep quiet. They would tell me to mind how I talked, and Miss Lucille gave me her hat, or a hat. The notary then questioned her. Question, "Is that the money, the reason you didn't tell the solicitor yesterday about all this? That Miss Lucille and the others had told you not to say anything about what happened at home there?" Answer, "Yes, sir." "Is that true?" "Yes, sir." "And that's the reason you would rather have been locked up last night than tell?" "Yes, sir." "Has Mr. Pickett or Mr. Cravens, both connected to Albert McKnight's place of employment, or Mr. Campbell, police detective, or myself, influenced you in any way or threatened you in any way to make this statement?" "No, sir." "You make it of your own free will and accord in their presence and in the presence of Mr. Gordon, your attorney?" "Yes, sir." "Signed, Manola McKnight." MINOLA MCKNIGHT, capital K. "Sworn to and subscribed before me this third day of June, 1913. Signed, G.C. February, Notary Public, Fulton County, Georgia." McKnight's sworn affidavit is, in fact, the strongest evidence of any confession in the case. She soon thereafter retracted her statement under highly suspicious circumstances and turned on the police. Quote, "They tried to get me to say that Mr. Frank would not allow his wife to sleep that night, and that he told her to get up and get his gun and let him kill himself, and that he made her get out of bed. They had my husband there to bulldoze me, claiming that I had told him that. I had never told him anything of the kind." And then there's a footnote, 1101. So literally 1,100 footnotes, 90% through book. Well, there's going to be one other we'll read in just a second. Here, she is suggesting that she had been coerced by the Atlanta police into making those claims, but Mrs. McKnight's retraction did not include any details of how her elaborate crime of perjury came to be. Footnote 1102, which reads, quote, "I signed it to get out of jail because they said they would not let me out." Albert McKnight swore on January 9, 1914, 5 months after the verdict, that his boss, R.L. Craven, concocted the story in a scheme to collect the $1,000 reward offered by the city. McKnight specifically denied that the prosecution had any role in the scheme. He was later found badly injured in the, quote, colored infirmary. And then there's a quote. McKnight also stated that Manola McKnight, his wife, had told him after the trial that the affidavit she had signed was true. He then confirmed that his testimony at the trial was true and testified to the fact that his affidavit to the contrary was false. Again, these people are being pressured. And then there's a quote in that same 1102. He declares he signed his repudiation affidavit in order to, quote, get rid of C.W. Burke, a private detective attached to the office of Luther Z. Rosser, senior member of the Leo Frank case, his one of his main two defending lawyers. He told the chief that he had been pestered unmercifully, direct quote, since having signed the repudiating document, and that he was so tired of it all that he was perfectly willing to go to jail and stay indefinitely. Chief Beaver stated to a Constitution reporter last night that McKnight could remain at police headquarters just as long as the Negro felt that he needed protection. So the simple black cook and her husband are under immense pressure to repudiate after they tell the truth from these paid harassers, essentially, private detectives or paid suborners of perjury and crooks, literal crooks, paid to help out Leo Frank. Back to the main text. Her revelation, however, cannot be easily dismissed. That is Mignola McKnight. Black cooks and maids working in white households from slavery on forward, from slavery on forward, vigilantly listen to the conversation of their employers, often as a matter of life and death. It is through those conversations that blacks heard of plans to sell slaves and slave children, plans to whip or kill another slave, plans of Klan activity, or plans of any other actions by whites that might affect the black community. Lynching plans might first be revealed in the homes of white planters, and it was the maids and, quote, help, feigning ignorance, who were positioned best to give advance warning to black targets. So blacks function as an informal spy network for among the whites they live in, naturally, because they have their own interests to look after. In fact, say the NOI researchers, Mignola McKnight did fully intend to keep this information concealed. She revealed it only to her husband, Albert, who from time to time visited his wife and did odd jobs in the Frank household. Okay, so he wasn't actually employed there, but he would do some stuff for him and come through there. It was Albert McKnight who revealed the details of his wife's story at his workplace, and it was Albert's employers who then notified police. The police confronted Mignola, leading to the extraordinary affidavit. More telling, the Seligs and the Franks, when faced with their Negro servant publicly outing them in such a damaging way, chose to keep the woman on as their employee. One must question how such a devastating betrayal could be so easily swept under the rug. In effect, she confirmed all that James Conley had told of Frank's hand in Mary Fagan's demise. Far less of an offense had earned a multitude of blacks early graves, yet McKnight reported for work at the Selig residence the very next day. One might accurately surmise that a fired Mignola, one with an excellent memory for detail and nothing to lose, could do far more damage to Frank's alibi than an employed and better paid Mignola. Too dangerous to fire her, just raise her wages and tell her to shut up, at least from this point. No servant would have hesitated to tell every negative thing she knew about the Seligs, the Franks, their relatives and visitors, their benign birth conversations, their drinking habits, their racial and religious attitudes, their gossip, and far more, given the condescending attitude of Mrs. Selig when she testified in court about her wage-paying habits. Quote, Mrs. Selig says, I have never raised Mignola's wages one penny since she has been with me. Mignola was paid $3.50 a week. I advanced her a week's wages. I don't know what week that was. I didn't pay her anything the next week. The first week I gave her $5 and told her to give me the change. She brought $1 the next morning and told me that she kept 50 cents, which I deducted the next week. I think Mrs. Frank gave her a hat. I don't know when that was. Mrs. Frank has never given her any money to my knowledge. Clearly, the purchase of Mignola's retraction, further securing her silence, would have been Leo Frank's only option. Another fact of interest that lends support to the veracity of Mignola's original story is that her tale would be legally classed as simple hearsay. As truthful as she seems to be, her account could not be used as evidence, and as a Negro woman in the Jim Crow South, she would be all but ignored in any decision involving the fate of a white man. So the question is, why would the police use her to create an elaborate fiction for such a nominal legal result? If the police or prosecutors were trying to frame Leo Frank, as has been charged, and they for some reason chose a black maid, would not they give Mignola a far stronger story to tell? Why the circuitous route through Mrs. Frank to Manola's husband, to his employers, and then to the police, only to tell an inconclusive, legally unusable tale? Why wouldn't they just have her say, I heard Mr. Frank say he killed the girl, or, quote, I washed the blood from his clothes, or, quote, he gave me the girl's purse to hide, or simply use her plant damning evidence in Frank's house, something that would have true legal weight. Police had many, many opportunities to frame Leo Frank if that were their intention, and Manola's story would have been far down the list of effective options. In the end, Manola McKnight's original story was almost certainly true as she told it, and it remains the best evidence of a confession to the murder of Mary Fagan. Ultimately, though, Manola may have had to pay for betraying the trust of her white master. In April of 1914, her face was cut by an assailant whom she refused to identify, according to reports, leaving her alive but injured with a 5-inch wound. So that's what happens to her a year after the murder. Next section, Judge Roan Stout. So anyway, the key here is the black cook at the house where Leo Frank lives overhears his wife telling her mother, who also lived there, that, yeah, Leo Frank admitted he murdered Mary Fagan. He was drunk. He was really off his game mentally, and he wanted a gun to shoot himself, or was at least thinking in those terms and mentioning it out loud. So that tells you the truth. There's no doubt here. The Jews are just trying to stir up clouds of dust to obscure the plain truth. Next subsection, Judge Roan's doubts, ? Judge Roan's doubts? On October 31st, 1913, 2 months after the guilty verdict ended the original trial, Judge Leonard F. Roan denied Frank's motion for a new trial, and in doing so, he commented, quote, "I am not convinced of the guilt or innocence of the defendant, but I do not have to be convinced. The jury was convinced, and that was enough." Those 28 words from the presiding judge have been taken by Frank's defenders as, quote, "proof that the judge believed Frank to be innocent." In truth, Judge Roan was carefully expressing his obligatory judicial impartiality. Had he expressed an opinion one way or the other, he would have been committing an error that each side could use as grounds to appeal the verdict. More indicative of Roan's actual opinion of the jury's decision was his conferring upon Frank the severest possible penalty, death by hanging. Georgia law gave him the clear option to impose a lighter sentence or even to vacate the conviction or declare a mistrial, but in the very moment he was making that much-discussed statement, he was officially denying Frank a new trial. Nevertheless, Frank and his supporters immediately latched onto the judge's words, not his sentence or his denial of a new trial, as a form of vindication. So they took his words out of context. They tried to act like something that was obligatory was actually weight on their side or indication the judge felt for the defense. Over the years, Judge Roan's name has been attached to a slew of other exoneration falsehoods. Some claim that during an impromptu meeting in the judge's chambers with the defense counsel, Judge Roan is alleged to have said, quote, "If Christ and his angels came down here and showed this jury that Frank was innocent, it would bring him in guilty." That's a direct quote. And though the tale has been liberally disseminated, the original source is dubious, third-hand hearsay. Indeed, Frank's attorney Luther Rosser, who was said to be in attendance when the alleged words were uttered, never mentioned the remark, which to a defense or appeals attorney and to the public relations campaign that soon commenced would have been a godsend. More than a year after the trial, Roan's, quote, "sentiments" were revived once again when Frank's lawyers alleged that the judge had confessed in a letter his ambivalence about the Frank verdict and his belief that Frank should have a new trial. Roan died of cancer in a Massachusetts hospital in March of 1915, and the letter remained in the possession of Leo Frank's attorneys and was not revealed to the public or to the Roan family for more than 2 months after his death. Here is that November 29, 1914, letter addressed to Luther Rosser's law firm, Rosser and Brandon, and attorney Reuben Arnold. Colon, quote, "Gentlemen, after considering your communication, asking that I recommend executive clemency in the punishment of Leo M. Frank, I wish to say that at the proper time I shall ask the prison commission to recommend and the governor to commute Frank's life sentence to life imprisonment, or I'm sorry, to commute Frank's sentence, to, which was for hanging to death, to life imprisonment. This, however, I will not do until the defendant's application shall have been filed and the governor and prison commission shall have had opportunity to study the record in the case. It is possible that I showed undue deference to the opinion of the jury in this case when I allowed their verdict to stand. They said by their verdict that they had found the truth. I was still in a state of uncertainty and so expressed myself. My search for the truth, though diligent and earnest, had not been so successful. In the exercise of judicial discretion, restricted and limited, according to my interpretation of the decisions of the reviewing courts, I allowed the jury's verdict to remain undisturbed. I had no way of knowing it was erroneous. After many months of continued deliberation, I am still uncertain of Frank's guilt. This state of uncertainty is largely due to the character of the Negro Conley's testimony, by which the verdict was evidently reached. Therefore, I consider this a case in which the chief magistrate of the state should exert every effort in ascertaining the truth. The execution of any person whose guilt has not been satisfactorily proven to the constituted authorities is too horrible to contemplate. I do not believe that a person should meet with the extreme penalty of the law until the court, jury, and governor shall all have been satisfied of that person's guilt. Hence, at the proper time, I shall express and enlarge upon these views directly to the governor and prison commission. However, if for any cause I am prevented from doing this, you are at liberty to use this letter at the hearing. Very truly yours, Seal L.S. Roan. Many, including members of Roan's family, doubted the authenticity of the letter, so the Jews forged it, is what they thought. According to Mary Fagan Keene's book, which we made an audiobook out of, quote, Roan family members indicate that at the time the letter was written, Judge Roan's physical and mental state were critical. They also stated that one of Leo Frank's lawyers went to the sanatorium, and it was at this time that the letter was written and signed by Roan. The family also felt that since Judge Roan refused Frank a new trial, the letter causes some questions. Roan's own pastor, the Reverend H.C. Emery, said the judge held the opinion that, quote, according to the evidence, Frank was unquestionably guilty. Whether the letter was composed by one of Frank's attorneys, as many suspect, or by Roan himself, the text contains the same telltale racism characteristic of the Frank's team's defense strategy. The letter's emphasis on Conley as a, quote, Negro, as well as the suggestion of the inappropriateness of Negro testimony, always in quotes, was the Frank team's trial and public relations strategy. A white man wouldn't do this, let alone a Jew. This is a black crime. This is a Negro crime. We can't burn this man. We can't hang this man on the basis of Negro testimony. They're stock in trade. The language, quote, by which the verdict was evidently reached, unquote, raises questions about whether the writer was even at the trial, for certainly Roan would be, literally, the best judge of how the verdict was evidently reached. Also, Roan had not shown overt signs of this kind of racism during the trial, except, of course, that he allowed Frank's attorneys to repeatedly verbalize and demonstrate theirs. In fact, Roan allowed much Negro testimony into the trial to Leo Frank's obvious frustration. Judge Roan's words have been liberally misconstrued and even invented by Frank's backers. The Anti-Defamation League attorney Dale Schwartz, for example, made an entirely slanderous assertion in 1989. Quote, in the judges, Roan's charge to the jury, he said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you have heard the testimony of Jim Conley, a nigger in this case. We all know that niggers don't tell the truth unless they're forced to, and you don't have to believe the testimony of this nigger, if you don't want to, against the testimony of white witnesses. The record shows that only three individuals used that kind of vicious racial invective. Leo Frank and his two attorneys, Luther Rosser and Reuben Arnold, not Judge Roan. So the ADL is concocting false quotes, fabricating quotes, the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League defames people. So it's the typical gaslighting and inversion of terms, flip terms. They say we're against defamation as they defame. And that pattern you will find in everything Jews do. Inversion of the truth, another way of putting they're liars. And there are many subspecies of lie. There are many different techniques for lying. And the Jews are expert in all of them, it would seem. Had Judge Roan composed the letter, it is more likely that he would have allowed its immediate release, given his deteriorating condition and the impending execution of Leo Frank, and he would have released it in the proper judicial forum, certainly not through Frank's attorneys, because that would be biased. The Frank team was obsessed with the, quote, Negro issue at the trial and in their subsequent efforts to obtain a new trial for the condemned man. Add to that obsession the extraordinary number of letters and notes in the Leo Frank drama that appear in a suspicious manner and at critical times. The false Carter letters, Frank's phony time slip for Newt Lee, attorney Henry A. Alexander's photographically altered factory stationery, Detective William A. Burns's many false affidavits, and now belatedly Rosser and Brandon's alleged Roan letter. All present a pattern of dubiously sourced documents, all for Leo Frank's benefit. So all these lies and forgeries tend in the same direction. They're all done by the same team of people, or paid for by them. It proves Albert Lasker's comments about the actions of his own hired private eye, William J. Burns. Quote, Lasker, the guy who ran the campaign in favor of Leo Frank, said, by God, of William J. Burns, he put in as much perjured stuff as the upside did before we finished. I don't say he did. He had his operatives, I guess. You can run that sort of thing until it embarrassed our case at times. The Roan letter was just another such embarrassment. And then a new section, did Frank convince his lynchers? During the 170-mile journey to his own lynching, it has been claimed Leo Frank, quote, asserted his innocence so persuasively that several of his abductors were convinced that they had the wrong man. Among those trafficking in the false claim was Frank's own attorney, Lewis Marshall, and author Melissa Faye Green adds, quote, one refused to go on with it and urged that Frank be returned to the prison, unquote. Leonard Dinnerstein tells a similar tale that Frank had convinced his lynchers that he had really not murdered Mary Fagan. Again, if Jew, then lie. Steve Oney wrote in 1985 that, quote, a tense debate broke out. After several sharp exchanges, the faction advocating mercy was overruled. End quote. But Oney drops that dramatic claim in his 2003 book, And the Dead Shall Rise, making no mention of it in his chapter-long account of the lynching. Now, I mean, think about that. How do you write? There's no new. This is all decades and decades after this stuff happened. There's no new evidence to drag up. The Jews are they're trying to calculate like which lie will serve us best. They'll bring forward a lie, and then a couple decades later they'll dump that lie and they'll go with a new one. And not even a different Jew, the same goddamn Jew. In one book he asserts this, and then all of a sudden that's totally gone, and he's off in another direction. It's all calculated against its immediate reception. No regard for consistency. It's like someone said about the whole, their lies aren't even remotely plausible. It really is bizarre, but you have to think of them as a different species with an entirely different mindset that has evolved this way of getting a leg over in the rest of us and living off us and parasitizing us by inducing guilt in us and blaming us, even in this case where it's as absolutely extremely black and white as it possibly can be against them. They managed to turn themselves into a victim. You have a Jew, a 29-year-old Jew who's married and cheating on his wife, who murders a 13-year-old girl after raping. And yeah, jabbing someone into someone's vagina is a rape. And after punching her and after strangling her,
And for 100 years later, the Jews go so far as to write musicals making this pedophile rapist murderer the victim. Isn't that amazing? That's the kind of race we're dealing with here. It's astonishing, but only if you think that all people are somehow the same, all created by God is the typical, oh, gee, who created that? Well, it's the same Steve Oney's created that garbage. Whites have been suckered in 1,000 ways by this race. And just now they're starting to kind of rub the sleep out of their eyes and kind of vaguely make out what's actually going on. And it's so much deeper than you could even imagine. Amazing stuff. Thomas E. Watson openly advocated for Frank's, quote, irregular execution, unquote, and would probably have had the best inside sources to gain knowledge of the actions of the lynchers. He says that, quote, twice in the 7-hour automobile ride of 170 miles, Frank was asked if he killed Mary Fagan. He did not answer. Not once in all that long ride to death did he protest his innocence. All evidence refutes the claims that Leo Frank argued on his own behalf in his final ride to Fry's Gin. The only words Frank is believed to have said during that fateful night were his request that his wedding ring be returned to his wife. Frank's lynchers actually granted and honored Frank's last request, which was carried out immediately and respectfully by his murderers. And finally, the last subsection we're going to do in this session. As we do the rest of 433 and 434. Lost files and non-existent teeth marks. Dutch journalist Pierre Van Passen, P-A-A-S-S-E-N, Pierre Van Passen, Dutch journalist, claimed that in 1922, he had gained access to documents, x-rays, and photos not presented at the trial that indicated Mary Fagan had been bitten on her left shoulder and neck before being strangled. In the lengthy medical testimony, there is nothing that refers to any evidence of bite or teeth marks in the victim. Van Passen concluded, however, that, quote, photos of the teeth marks in her body did not correspond with Leo Frank's set of teeth, of which several photos were included, unquote. He provided no details of how he could have made this determination, and no subsequent writer, historian, attorney, medical examiner, dentist, or investigator of any kind has made any similar claims. But Van Passen's efforts are noteworthy, again a Dutch journalist, because of the resistance he claims to have encountered when gathering this information in quotes. He says he was thwarted by Frank's Jewish attorney, Henry A. Alexander, quote, he said the Jewish community in its entirety still felt nervous about the incident. If I wrote the articles, old resentments might be stirred up, and who knows, some of the unknown lynchers might recognize themselves as participants in my description of the lynching. It was better, Mr. Alexander thought, to leave sleeping lions alone. Some local rabbis were drawn into the discussion, and they actually pleaded to stop me from reviving interest in the Frank case, as this was bound to have evil repercussions on the Jewish community. Van Passen further implied that his attempts to gather information from Frank's supporters resulted in a late-night attempt in his own life. Quote, that someone had blabbed out of school became quite evident when I received a printed warning saying, quote, lay off the Frank case if you want to stay healthy, or keep healthy. Direct quote, lay off the Frank case if you want to keep healthy. The unsigned warning was reinforced one night, or rather early one morning, when I was driving home. A large automobile drove up alongside of me and forced me into the track of a fast-moving streetcar coming from the opposite direction. My car was demolished, but I escaped without a scratch. And that's footnote 1124 that reads, see his book, To Number Our Days. When, in more recent times, Harvard attorney Alan Dershowitz attempted to obtain that, quote, evidence, he found that Alexander's Jewish partner, Max Goldstein, had, quote, destroyed the file, a file that one must then assume implicated Leo Frank in, not cleared him of, the murder of Mary Fagan. not again, but for footnote 125 or 1125, 1125 reads, Oney speaks of secret files containing, quote, damaging information, quote, never made public and accessible only to a few. Max F. Goldstein of Atlanta was the senior member of the law firm Powell, Goldstein, Frazier, and Murphy, and Arthur G. Powell had previously represented Frank's hired detectives of the William J. Burns Agency against perjury and other serious charges. Goldstein wrote, I accept full responsibility for advising Judge Powell to destroy the memorandum because, with the state of public feeling, no one would have believed the truth of it, and it would have merely resulted in renewing the agitation which, by that time, had died down considerably. So they're lying after the fact. Oh, well, we had some evidence. Well, you know, let's just let it go because the public's all stirred up. But, you know, just a further way to add some stuff into their ridiculous claims that their man wasn't guilty when they all know goddamn well he was. Anyway, that will do it for our little survey today. And we have two more segments to go in NOI's Volume 3 of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, the Leo Frank case, the lynching of a guilty Jew. Well, they say the lynching of a guilty man. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.